We've been going through our series lately we call Thrones, and this is a little mini series within our bigger series. And so I just want to remind you of kind of the layout here. We've been journeying from the beginning of the Hebrew scriptures of the Old Testament since last year, working our way, and we're in this time period of Israel's history where the kingdom has been divided. We actually started this little series, Thrones, a few weeks ago with the dividing of the kingdom of Israel into two, never to be reunited again. And the northern kingdom became known as Israel. It was all Israel before, but now the northern tribes became known as the northern kingdom or Israel, and the southern tribe of Judah, Benjamin, and some of the Levites became known as the southern kingdom or Judah. So Israel, Judah, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. And we saw these dual thrones, these dual kingdoms going on, and we're doing this series to celebrate that, to study that together. And we've worked through several. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we were in the northern section, burning through like six straight kings in a row to get to where we are today. And last week, we saw three kings in the south at the same time that six kings reigned up north, because the kings in the south were passed on generationally, whereas up north, they were assassinating political leaders and taking over their kingdoms and replacing them. So a lot has been happening to bring us to where we are today. We just finished talking about Jeroboam and Rehoboam and all the Boehm brothers, and now we're beyond them, and we're going to talk about a new personality today. And this is where we slow it down as far as the story pace, because a character comes in today that is going to be very interesting, and we want to take time to get to know them. We left off up north with King Omri. King Omri bought the land that we call Samaria today, very large area, built the royal fixtures for the north up there. It's like the third capital up north now in Samaria. Cities like Jezreel and others are there. And so as they settle down in place, Omri eventually dies, and the seventh king of the northern kingdom will take the throne, and that's where our story starts today. It's a whole new era. 1 Kings 16:29 tells us this. Ahab, son of Omri, began to rule over Israel in the 38th year of King Asa's reign down in Judah. And Ahab reigned in Samaria for 22 years. And for 22 years, his kingdom will be defined in some pretty crazy ways. He's not a good king. It says in verse 30, but Ahab, son of Omri, did what was evil in the Lord's sight, even more than any of the kings who were before him. And that's saying something, because this is the northern kingdom. They have had Jeroboam. Jeroboam, whose legacy has been that he sinned and he caused Israel to sin with him. That's a pretty reputable legacy. And has that been a good king since then? Remember, Jeroboam was the one who, when the kingdom divided, he was afraid his people would go back to the south and worship at the temple of Jerusalem. So to keep his kingdom safe politically, and the people were angry at the south, that's why the kingdom broke into two, he said, let's reject their politics and let's reject their faith as well. And so he made two golden calves and said, worship these golden calves instead. And the people did. They were so angry, they were glad to do that. And so they walked away. And so he not only walked away himself, but he led the Israel to sin. His legacy, the legacy of Jeroboam, became the man who made Israel sin with him. And now six kings have gone, and Ahab is here, but he's the worst one yet, it says. That's pretty remarkable. In fact, it explains in verse 31, it says this, that as though it were not enough to follow the sinful example of Jeroboam, he married Jezebel, the daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians, and he began to bow down in the worship of Baal. Now, I want to talk about this for a little bit, but let me preface all I'm going to say by saying that the name of this false, idolatrous religion worshiping Baal, that name Baal is a very unusual name, and there's been pronunciation issues around it. I grew up in church always hearing it referred to as Baal, worshiping Baal, as I always said. And then I came to realize later that there's other more correct ways that are somewhat debated, but largely not. Some say Baal. But Baal is the proper pronunciation. It's actually like two syllables, believe it or not. It's Baal. And I can never say it right. Sometimes I throw E sounds. I'll make random vowel noises. I'll probably say Baal. Who knows? But when you see that name, that's who we're talking about, okay? So anyhow, we've met Baal before, along with Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. So I want to remind you, months ago when the Israelites were wandering towards the land that would become their kingdom, They encountered this already, and God warned them. It was a messed up religion because they had, you know, Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Baal were fertility gods and goddesses. They had built in religious practices that included cult, temple prostitution, trafficking, child sacrifice, and all sorts of messed up stuff. It was a dark place, and God always warned them, stay far away. But of course, the people will always do what they're going to do, even in any place. And so as the northern kingdom walked away, as they abandoned the faith of the God of Israel, the monotheistic creator of the world, who met them personally and led them from Egypt and said, know me as Yahweh, your creator. As they walked away from him, because of political reasons, they abandoned their faith as well, and they worshiped these two golden calves. How stupid is that? Like, they made their own gods with their hands. And as they did that, it was such a hollow replacement that the real tragedy was not worshiping the calves, it was walking away from God. And so over generations, that didn't hold much weight anymore. So now they're going to bring a more substantive alternative into the kingdom, worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth and all of its dark and vulgar practices. And of course, you see the names on the screen. Ahab does this by marrying Jezebel, who's the daughter of King Ethbaal. Now, you know this is true even to this day. People often name themselves or their children after their religion, right? Or perhaps people will even change their names in some places to, if they embrace a new religion, they'll change their names for their religion. You'll see that sometimes. So King Ethbaal and even his daughter Jezebel were all named in worship of their Baal worship. And so when Ahab marries her and brings her into the kingdom, he embraced her and he embraced this idolatry to replace the hollow golden calf stuff. Again, still abandoning God who brought them out of slavery into Egypt, into Israel. So now he's doing this terrible stuff with her. And Ahab and Jezebel are famous characters. In verse 32, it says that Ahab first built a temple and an altar for Baal in Samaria. Then he set up an Asherah pole. Those were very obscene, by the way. Asherah pole. He did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than any of the other kings of Israel before him. This guy takes it to a whole new depth. And their household names, that's the king. You've heard those names before, no doubt, even in pop culture references. Ahab and Jezebel, right? We know those names. But there's another name that comes on the scene. First you meet the king, now we're going to meet the prophet. Because it's very interesting, at a time of Israel's darkest moment, God raises up a light in the darkness. And that's so much like God to do that. It's interesting that when there's times when things are pretty good, you don't always notice those personalities stand out as much, perhaps because there's so much light everywhere when things are good. But when times get dark, maybe the light just stands out more. Or maybe God does something special when it's most needed and raises up people for times. And somehow God says the nation needs an Elijah. So he brings Elijah onto the scene, and his name is as big as anybody's. And God brings him into the story when Israel was at its darkest point for such a time as this. It says in chapter 17 and verse 1, now Elijah, who was from Tishbe in Gilead, told King Ahab, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, the God I serve, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years until I give the word. Now that's a pretty gutsy statement. Can we be real here? Somehow Elijah gets an audience in the presence of King Ahab. I don't know if he goes to the royal palace in Samaria or in Jezreel, where he's often held court, and if he waits in line for his turn to talk, or I don't know if he meets the king in the town square somewhere, but no doubt there were witnesses around whenever it happened, and he lets the king know that there's going to be no more rain or dew for a few years until he says so, because God has the message. He's getting their attention. And then Elijah says this, and Elijah's gone. He disappears. And I'm sure at first he was a punchline. It was like, oh, okay, no rain or dew. Nice. But then as the days go by and kind of the weeks trickle by and there's no rain, you might be starting to like say, oh, yeah, you know, hashtag Elijah was right, apparently. You know, we got nothing falling down. It's bad, but it won't last. And then weeks turn to months and then years. And you know what a drought's going to bring? A drought brings a famine. I mean, there's still the sea. They're actually really by the sea up there. But that's not going to put rain inland. That's not going to bring rain to the crops. And so as the drought comes, famines come, things suffer, and now everyone's going through it, and this goes on. And now Elijah's name is not just a joke for a few people who heard it. Now everyone in the country knows Elijah's name because as people start to say, hey, hasn't been rain in a while. Well, you heard what Elijah the prophet, who? A guy named Elijah showed up and told Ahab there'd be no rain. And all of a sudden that word spreads until everyone in the country knows who Elijah is because there ain't no rain coming down. And they're looking for him, but he's gone. He was like, I'm out of here. In fact, for a while, God supernaturally provides for him. And we're going to skip parts of the story for sake of time. But God does something special in verse 8. Then the Lord said to Elijah, go and live in the village of Zarephath near the city of Sidon. I have instructed a widow there to feed you. God sends him out of the country. Now, that's not very far away. In fact, this region would also be affected by a global, you know, by a regional famine and the economic downturn that would come from such times as that. They would also be affected. And so Elijah goes there. Guess where? The city of Sidon. Folks, that's where Jezebel's family is from, Ahab's wife. That's where they brought some of the worship of Baal from. It's almost like God sends Elijah there saying, hey, you know, you bring your gods over to here, I'll send my God over to you now. So he goes over to Sidon, and God says, I'm going to let a widow take care of you. Now, a widow taking care of him is remarkable. I often remind you that women didn't have a very high status in society back then. There's still a lot of, you know, there's a long ways to go in parts of the world still today, but it was really bad back then. Like they, you know, they couldn't own property, they couldn't hold positions in many places. They counted on a man to take care of them. Especially, of course, any woman struggling to raise kids and do that is hard enough, let alone with cultural barriers. And so if a woman never married, she'd stay with her parents. If she was a widow, if they were alive, they'd take care of each other. If she had kids who were older, they'd take care of her. But if she was alone or raising young kids, she could often be in trouble. Maybe this is a rich widow. Maybe she's defying the odds, right? Maybe she inherited a whole lot of money from her husband, and she's going to take care of Elijah. I mean, he's got nothing else to do but meet a rich widow. Maybe she's single. Who knows? Anyhow, but he's going to go to Sidon and see what happens next. Well, we pick up the story in verse 10. So Elijah went to Zarephath, and as he arrived at the gates of the village, he saw a widow gathering sticks, and he asked her, would you please bring me a little water in a cup? And of course, God's already told her. We saw earlier God had told her prophet's coming, so maybe she thinks, you know, she doesn't think stranger danger. She thinks, oh, this is the guy. So she goes ahead and gets him a little water. As she was going to get it, he called to her, hey, bring me a bite of food too. And this is where the story gets interesting. Bring me some food too. Verse 12, but she said, I swear by the Lord your God that I don't have a single piece of bread in the house. And I have only a handful of flour left in the jar. And a little cooking oil in the bottom of the jug. I was just gathering a few sticks, make a little fire, to cook a last meal. And then my son and I will die. So she has a young son, and she's a widow, and she doesn't have anything. And the economic downturn caused by the drought has affected her adversely because of her station in life. It's impacted her worse than others in her region. And she's like, I'm on my last bite of food. We're going to eat our last of our food, and then we're going to die. So I'm sorry. And Elijah's probably thinking, I must have got the wrong zip code. You know, it must be the wrong widow because this woman can't help me, right? But Elijah knew better. In verse 13, Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go ahead and do just what you've said, but make a little bread for me first. And then use what's left to prepare a meal for you, for yourself, and for your son. To which I'd be thinking if I were her, were you paying attention to our conversation just now? I feel like you weren't really listening. I just told you I don't have enough food to feed you. I have enough food to feed me and my son one last meal, and then we're done. If I make a food for you first, we ain't eating nothing. So I can't go do what I said I would do. But I think she knew because God had spoken to her before he arrived. He told Elijah he had already instructed a widow to take care of him. So she knew. But she didn't know. Come on now. Let's be honest. Let's be pious. How much faith we have. When we're in scary times, we wonder. We doubt. And she's sitting there saying, I don't know what's going to happen. And now the guy's saying, make me the meal first. I got one meal left. Make it for me first. why. He explains to her before she goes in verse 14. Elijah says, "For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. There will always be flour and olive oil left in your containers until the time when the Lord sends rain and crops grow again. Until this whole thing is over, God's going to keep taking care of you." He promises her that. Doesn't promise she's going to, you know, win the jackpot, get a new, you know, castle. He just says, there'll always be more food. God's going to sustain you. You're going to get by. He's going to keep, somehow there's always going to be more food. And always going to be more food. And you're going to get through this whole season. So don't worry about it. Just trust the Lord. Verse number 15 says, So she did as Elijah said. And she and Elijah and her family continued to eat for many days. And there was always enough flour and olive oil left in the containers, just as the Lord promised through Elijah. And she lived the rest of that famine, feeding herself. It's amazing. You go back to the barrel and, well, there's a barrel, apparently more for another meal. Go back to the oil, there's enough for another meal. And then the next time it's time to eat, what do you know? There's enough for another meal. There's still enough left. It's always enough, day by day, to keep going. And she just had to trust God. God asked her to do something first. That would have some, she could have said, no, I got to take care of me first. If there's anything left over, I'll take care of you. But she said, I'll do that. I'll believe God. And God says, look, I'll take care of you. And there's a cool story here. In fact, it goes on. We're going to skip a lot of story because Elijah stays there for the entire famine. There's a whole episodes that go down with her and her son. I mean, there's a whole episodes that go down that, you know, supernatural interventions, again, miracles, that we're not even going to tell those stories today. Do you know why? Because sake of time. We're going to get back towards the king of Israel. We've got to go back to Israel now, away from this side story of this widow woman and her son in Sidon. We got to go back to the main story. So we'll skip all of that. And some of you today might be sitting here thinking, Arlen, yeah, you should go back to Israel. Hello, Arlen. This is a series called Thrones. It's not a series called Widows, okay? We're talking about Israel right now. Why do we even tell this whole story? And why do we at all leave the scene to go over here and talk about this little side story about this widow and her son and their little bit of food that God took care of them through Elijah throughout the famine? Let's go back to Israel. This is what we're talking about. And I agree, that's what we're talking about. But we wanted to take a detour and tell that story for two important reasons. One is because it's going to be part of our application today as we enter Holy Week. So hang on for that later. The second reason I wanted to go to that story is because hundreds of years later, Jesus would go to that story. Very interesting thing. When Jesus walked this earth and did his earthly ministry hundreds and hundreds of years later, he would sometimes tell the story. We have a record of him telling the story about that little widow woman over there in Sidon who trusted God and she took care of Elijah and God took care of her through the entire famine. And she becomes a fixture in the story of Jesus. And we're going to be there in a few months. We're going to get there, you know, starting Jesus' story in a few months, and then next year we'll be telling his story still. When we get to the story in the Gospels, and Jesus is telling it, I want you to remember today the story of Elijah and the widow woman. But we'll leave her alone for now and go back to Israel. God tells Elijah, time to go back, time to let the rain fall, time to end this whole deal with a climactic finish. And so Elijah does. He goes back. And guess what's happening in Israel? They are looking for him. They are looking for him. In fact, I'll tell you what's been happening. Ahab's been killing every prophet of God he could find. They're just executing them all. A lot of people who were up north who believed in God had already gone south to Judah. But those who were still there, who practiced their faith, if they got caught, Ahab executed them. Jezebel executed them. They were killing them. They had their own payroll of prophets of Baal and Ashtaroth that they looked to. And so they were killing the prophets of God. And they probably, let's be real here, they were probably using Elijah's prophecy of no rain and the drought as a reason to be extra angry and a reason to execute prophets of God. Look at the trouble they've caused. And so Elijah's like public enemy number one. They've been looking for him for years, and he waltzes into town one day. And when he shows up, he tells one of the officials of Ahab, there's a whole story there we're going to skip. He says to him, tell Ahab, I'm back. And the word spreads. Ahab hears it. He comes out to meet Elijah, And a bunch of people spread the word, and they all come out as a gathering place for this big epic moment between Elijah, who said it wouldn't rain, and sure enough it didn't, and King Ahab and all his power and cruelty. And in verse 17 it says, when Ahab saw Elijah, he exclaimed, "So is it really you, you troublemaker of Israel?" That was his welcome. Look what Elijah says. "I have made no trouble for Israel," he replied. "You and your family are the troublemakers. For you have refused to obey the commands of the Lord, and you have worshipped the images of Baal instead." Here's what he says. Don't put that on me. All this is happening because of you. You're worried about this physical drought and famine, but you have created such a spiritual drought and a spiritual famine that you don't think is very consequential, but is far more consequential for your health and the nation's future than a physical drought is. And so God's done what he's done to get your attention where you feel it, so that he can get through a message of who he is and turn you back to him. So don't blame me. I'm not the troublemaker. You're the troublemaker. Isn't that human nature for us to project on other people? You know, we do something wrong and then we get mad at the person who rats us out. Or we do something wrong and someone reacts poorly, then we're mad at them for how they handle it. Or we just deflect, instead of just owning our own junk. And so here's Ahab, "You caused some trouble." And I say, "No, really, you've caused the trouble." Okay? But now Elijah's, look, they want him dead. They want him dead right now. But there's a crowd of people, and I don't know why Ahab doesn't kill him. Ahab probably says, "Before I kill you, could you do me a favor and pray for some rain, you know?" I don't know. The rain would be helpful. So Elijah offers them a challenge in verse 19. He says, "Now summon all of Israel to join me at Mount Carmel, along with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who were supported by Jezebel. You and your wife's whole religion, bring all the 850 people up there, and tell the nation to join you." Sure enough, Ahab summoned all the people of Israel and the prophets of Mount Carmel. Now, why did he do it again? Probably because this was a big epic moment. And he wants to show Israel that he's going to confront the guy who he considers the problem. And he's hoping rain's going to come back too, by the way. So they all show up to Mount Carmel to deal with Elijah. And by the way, it says all the people came. You know why? Because Netflix was down that day. They couldn't watch anything anyhow. So they were bored. But no, because this is the epic event. There is nothing more exciting going on in the land than the idea of facing the guy who said that it wouldn't rain and it hasn't for a few years. So people show up en masse for the showdown. And when they get there, Elijah's going to address the crowd in verse 21. Elijah stood in front of them and he said, "How much longer? How much longer will you waver, hobbling between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, then follow him." Now, here's what Elijah was saying. By the way, this is the whole point. This is why all of this has happened for this moment. He says, "Listen, guys, I know that a few generations ago, your new king, when you divided, pulled you away from the worship of the God who brought you out of slavery and bondage generations ago and brought you to this land and gave you everything you have. And you pulled away from it. You walked away. But some of you haven't. Some of you are trying to keep your faith still despite it, because no one ever participates with the government initiatives anyhow, right? So you're still trying to be people of faith. And some of you went over and worshiped the golden calves, and some of you are worshiping Baal. And some of you are just confused and you're kind of playing both sides. Stop it." He says, "How long are you going to be divided? If the Lord is God, if he's God, then we should follow him. Come on now. If he's not, we shouldn't. But if Baal is God, then you should follow him. Let's figure this thing out." Now the people, it says, the people were completely silent. No one says a word, because what are you going to say? What do you say in a moment like this? I mean, they're probably afraid of the king. Or they're just curious. We're hoping for rain. And then Elijah said to them, "I am the only prophet of the Lord who is left, but Baal has 450 prophets." Now, I got to quickly say this here. That's not true. Elijah was not the only prophet of the Lord left. In fact, he knew it wasn't true. Because in a story that we skipped earlier, when he first came back into town, he was told by some of the government officials that they were secretly hiding prophets of God who weren't killed yet in caves and other places and feeding them to keep them alive. So there were plenty of other people out there who were prophets of the Lord. But I don't think Elijah's trying to lie when he says this. I think what he's trying to say is, hey, everyone else is in hiding somewhere. I'm the only one standing here. It's me and hundreds of you on the payroll of the king in this new religion of yours. And you've been killing all the guys like me, and you want to kill me today. It's me against all of you, and all the people are here. So he offers them a challenge. He's going to offer them a challenge. Instead of just killing him, he says, I'll tell you what. Let's put some stakes on the table. Let's make a deal. Let's put some consequences at the end of this thing. If death is on the line for me, let's put death on the line for everybody. He says this in verse 23, now bring two bulls. The prophets of Baal may choose whichever one they wish and cut it into pieces and lay it on the wood of their altar, but without setting fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull, lay it on the wood of the altar, but not set fire to it. There are multiple altars on Mount Carmel. There was an altar of the Lord that people who, when they used to follow the religion of, you know, the God that they worshiped who brought them out of slavery, Yahweh, as they did that, you know, if they couldn't go to Jerusalem, they would worship on mountains like this sometimes as an alternative. But they've abandoned that religion. They've abandoned their faith. So that altar's kind of broken down and not in great shape anymore. But next to it over here, a little close by, was another altar where they offered sacrifices to Baal and other things like that. And so Elijah says, take your altar. Let's both take a bull. Let's put a burnt offering. Let's kill the bull. Let's put the sacrifice on the altar with the wood, but no one sets it on fire. Well, that's kind of weird. Why not? How's it going to be an offering without fire? He explains in verse 24. He says, then call on the name of your God, and I'll call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by setting fire to the wood is the true God. And so everyone's going to be thinking, that's impossible. Of course, so is no rain for a few years, right? I mean, whatever, but that's impossible. And so the prophets of Baal probably think, this is crazy. Can't happen. But here's Elijah's showdown. Let's just figure out what's real. Let's just do something here. Ready? And so if the prophets of Baal didn't want to do it, they don't want to back down in front of the king who pays them and keeps them alive because he's pretty angry. They don't want to back down in front of the people who are, in fact, the people all agree. They're like, yeah, bring on the show, you know. So he's like, oh, great, we got to do this now. So they agree. And Elijah says to these guys, you go first. You guys go first. I'll wait. And so they do. They take their bull, they put the sacrifice, the meat on the altar. They get it all ready, and then they begin to pray to Baal to light the fire for hours. By the time lunch is over and there's still no fire coming down, Elijah begins to make fun of them. We're not reading the whole story, but he makes fun of them. He's like, guys, maybe Baal has hard of hearing in his old age. Maybe he's got a lot of wax buildup going on inside there. So I don't know. Maybe he's sleeping, and he's a deep sleeper. Can't hear you over the sleep apnea machine, you know. Maybe he's on vacation somewhere, and he didn't take his cell phone with him. I don't know, but keep trying. And he makes fun of them, and the people are hearing this. And so the prophets of Baal, I mean, they're strength in numbers, but they're looking kind of stupid. And so the king's watching, their employer's watching. So they begin to cut themselves and bleed and scream and wail, because even if it doesn't work, come on now, you got to put on a good show. Go down trying. Well, Elijah, meanwhile, begins to repair the damage to the altar of the Lord there. He begins to prepare the sacrifice on top of it, gets everything ready. Then he does something really weird. He takes a tool and he digs a trench around the altar. Like, what's he doing that for? And then he says to the guys, we're on Mount Carmel, which is right by the sea. Guys, go down to the sea and bring some barrels of water up here while we're waiting for them to finish praying for fire. Bring some water up here so they, you know, from the sea. So they do. And he's like, guys, pour it all over the sacrifice. And they do. They pour it on the meat, the stones, the wood. It's so much that it fills the trench with water. They're like, Elijah's not very bright. It's hard to set something on fire when it's drenched in water. What was he thinking? But Elijah is going for effect. He's going for shock and awe. He wants everyone to know something big's about to go down. So sure enough, eventually, he says to the other guys, your time is up. And in verse 36, at the usual time for offering the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet walked up to the altar and he prayed. And check out his prayer. He prayed this: "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, prove today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant. Prove that I have done all of this at your command." He continues, "O Lord," he says, "O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have brought them back to yourself." This is the whole point, folks. This right here is the reason everything has happened. So that Elijah can walk in as an unknown nobody one day and say, "Ain't gonna rain for a while." And so that the whole nation's paying attention a few years later. So they're all gathered, people are gathered on a mountain, and the legend will not be soon forgotten. So that in this moment, he can say to the people, "Why are you hobbling between two opinions? If he's God, then follow him." And he prays and says, "God, here's the moment. Show them who you are so they know that you're God, so that you want to bring them back to yourself." Here's the point. He says, "God, I'm not doing this for fame. I'm not doing this so that I can be an influencer, have a big TikTok following or whatever. That's not what I'm about right now. I'm not doing this to be a big shot. I'm doing this, God, because you told me to do it. Please show yourself strong so the people will come back to you, because you want them to come back to you more than anything." That's always been the point. To God, the worst thing about them was their idolatry, because it brought them from God. And he used this hard time to get their attention, to bring them back. Look at what happens next, verse 38. "Immediately the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven and burned up the young bull, the wood, the stones, and the dust, and even licked up all the water in the trench." That's pretty dramatic. In fact, so dramatic, it says in verse 39, when all the people saw it, they fell face down on the ground and they cried out, "The Lord, he is God. Yes, the Lord is God." Mission accomplished. This was the payoff. Yes, the people are back to a faith that they have either been abandoning themselves, or their leadership has been pulling them away from their faith and they've been wobbling a little bit, but now their faith is solid again. Mission accomplished. Here they are. The Lord is God. The Lord, he is God. Yes, the Lord. Yes. And now it's time to pay the piper, because I kind of skipped this in this hour, but the deal was, you know, there's consequences. Whoever calls down, "You want to kill me?" Elijah's like, "You want to kill me? Whoever calls on fire from heaven is the right one. The other side dies. So I'll die if I need to die, or you can die." This wasn't a deal for $100 and a bag of Doritos. This was like the winner lives. And Elijah just pulled it off, and the fire comes down. The people are like, "The Lord is God." They're all excited. So Elijah, crazy guy as he was, he commanded, "Seize all the prophets of Baal. Don't let a single one escape." And he goes down and does to them what they were going to do to him. The people seized them all. He took them down to the Kishon Valley and he killed them there. He's like, "My, how the turns have tabled," right? I mean, he is taking them out. And the people are ready. The people are like, "Yeah!" And what can the king do? Because the crowd was raucously excited. So then, after all that, the people head home. The people just kind of head back home, telling their story, coming to tell the kids and the cousins, you know. They all head home. And Elijah turns to the king, the prophet turns to the king, and Elijah says to him, "Hey, go get something to eat and drink, for I think I hear a mighty rainstorm coming." Oh, that will be a relief. So Ahab went to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed low to the ground, and he prayed with his face between his knees. And then he said to his servant, "Go and look out toward the sea." The servant went and looked, and then returned to Elijah and said, "I didn't see anything." Seven times Elijah told him to go and look. Finally, the seventh time, his servant told him, "I saw a little cloud about the size of a man's hand rising from the sea, from the horizon." And Elijah shouted, "Hurry to Ahab and tell him, climb into your chariot and go back home. If you don't hurry, the rain will stop you. You need to book it out of here, buddy." And soon the sky was black with clouds, a heavy wind brought a terrific rainstorm, much needed. And Ahab left quickly for Jezreel. Now, this part of the story we could have skipped, but I wanted to tell you to set us up for what comes after Easter, not next week. But I want you to see verse 46 to kind of hinge us to where we go next. In verse 46, it says this: Then the Lord gave special strength to Elijah. He tucked his cloak into his belt, because they had these, you know, big, hard-to-running outfits. Tucked his cloak into his belt, and he ran ahead of Ahab's chariot all the way to the entrance of Jezreel. Picture this. He is so pumped. Can you understand why Elijah would be pumped? He has been on this multi-year journey of watching God set a plan in place that has come to fruition that day. Fire has fallen from heaven. The rain is back. The people are saying, the Lord is God. The Lord is God. He is like, it's better than hitting the key, March Madness, hitting the three-point shot while time expires from the half-court mark, yeah, and draining the winning shot, and the team carries you off on their back. This is bigger than all of that. He just saw God do something so powerful that the adrenaline in him and the spirit of God in him causes him to run down the mountain ahead of Ahab's chariot entourage to go back to the city of Jezreel. He's pumped. And we're going to leave him there today. In a couple weeks from now, we're going to come back because the story isn't over. It's just getting started. But this part of the story is over, and it was big. And as we enter Holy Week today, as we enter the week where we celebrate the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is the day, Palm Sunday, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem and began to instigate his teachings in places where they already hated him in the religious community to the point where they wanted him crucified and eventually he would be arrested and killed. And we're going to do all of that on Friday and Sunday if you want to show up with us and join us. But for today, I wanted this message to be, I didn't want to skip one because we have a lot of ground to cover before the holidays in a few months. Also because this sets up the story. This sets up Holy Week so beautifully to me. Because it teaches us a truth in the story today that we also learn during Holy Week about God's love, about the gospel. The word gospel means good news. Sometimes church people forget that because it doesn't sound very much like good news where you go. Means good news. And the good news, we talk about the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus, yes, but all of that was to symbolize the good news of God's love, that God so loved the world that he gave his son. It's the message that John the disciple said when he said, God is love. That's the gospel. And as we promote that idea going into Holy Week, we see it in the story today. And here's the beautiful truth I want to share. Simple, but precious. That God cares for everyone and every one. We see it in the gospel, and we see it in the story of Elijah today. That here's God trying to get the attention of the nation of Israel. There'll be a famine in the land. There'll be a showdown on Mount Carmel. Hey, what did he say earlier? God wants you back to the nation of Israel, but also God sends him away during the famine to the city of Sidon, to the country of Sidon, to a city called Zarephath, to help one little widow woman and a young boy who weren't going to make it through an economic downturn and bolster their faith and take care of them because they were important too. Because God cares for everyone and God cares for every one. That's the gospel. That's what we celebrate this week. That's Holy Week. That God so loved the world that he gave his son. But that God loves the individual and left the 99 sheep behind to find the one. That if you were the only one that needed saving, you're worth it. I say it all the time that we have a God who is so powerful and yet so personal. Powerful enough to make the world in which we live, create everything, and yet personal enough to care about you, to know the number of hairs on your head, to know each tear you cry and why it was shed, and to keep record of that. You matter to him individually, and the world matters to him. And he's doing a macro thing, and he's caring for your current struggles and needs. And he's trying to fix the big picture, and he hears your private prayer. That God cares for everyone, and for every one. And that's the gospel. That's what we celebrate every week. And that's what Elijah showed us today on Mount Carmel and in Sidon or in Zarephath with a little widow woman. In fact, can I tell you something that I thought of this week that just really excited me because I'm weird? In the life of Jesus, hundreds of years later, in Jesus' entire ministry, not one time on record does Jesus ever tell the story of Elijah calling down fire from heaven and impressing the whole nation. That story, Jesus, if he told it, there's no record of him telling that story ever again. I mean, people knew it. It was written down. It was epic. But there's not one record of Jesus ever telling the story of Ahab and the nation and the fire, all that, not one time. But Jesus does go on record and tells the story about the little widow woman and her son in such a way that when Jesus tells it, it's memorable and impactful to his audience and to us even 2,000 years later. Sometimes the big stuff that God does doesn't seem big at the moment, but it's really big. And I want to encourage you today with this thought that God is so powerful and yet so personal, not just to encourage you about yourself, although that's good. God cares about you. That's a great truth. We'll get to that truth again soon. We get to that truth all the time, right? But I also want that to excite you about the purpose God gives you in life. Because we're all invited into doing the Lord's work, and we're not all exactly Elijah, but the scriptures tell us in the Christian writings that Elijah was a regular person like us. So that's what James, the brother of Jesus, once said. He's a person just like us, but he prayed. And so he's tangible, but we're not all Elijah. We don't all have exactly the calling Elijah had. But all of us want to have purpose in our lives. We all want to make a difference. We all want to make an impact in the world. And that's great, and God uses us sometimes to do that. But it's not always about being an influencer or having a big following. Sometimes it's not just the big stuff we do for the kingdom or the big stuff we do in partnership with others for the kingdom. Sometimes it's the stuff we do for the one, the individual who's overlooked, who's marginalized by society and culture. That person perhaps in your family who needs the extra love and attention and time. That person in your orbit, that person that you have crossed paths with, and you think, well, that's just one person. But God cares for everyone, and God cares for everyone. It may be the biggest impact you'll make. Like Jesus told the story later, is not the fire from heaven, but the widow. Maybe that's the impact that will be outsized over the years to come. So that encourages me as I serve the Lord. I want to see the big stuff go down. That's great. But I don't want to ever overlook the importance of the every one. That's you, that's me. We matter to God. And that's what Holy Week's going to be all about as we walk towards the cross and the resurrection in the days ahead. Let's enjoy the journey. We'll pick this up in 2 weeks. Let's pray.